Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
In the last 50 years, wildlife populations have, on average, declined by 60%. For the first time in human history, the stability of nature can no longer be taken for granted.
David Attenborough from the Netflix series Our Planet. Human behavior has played a big part in threatening nature for years. While today the United Nations released a biodiversity report, the news is dire. 1 million species of plants and animals at risk of extinction within decades. The good news, the authors of the report say it is not too late to change that outcome, but it is going to take a worldwide effort. Seth Bornstein is science reporter at the Associated Press. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Tell us the scope of this report. We've had reports like this in the past. What's different about this one?
Well, this is the first globally comprehensive report done by the United Nations to look at the causes, what can be done, and what'll be happening if nothing is done.
And the causes being what exactly?
There are five main causes. The first and foremost is habitat loss or degradation.
Degradation.
I'm sorry. I'm having a...
So habitat loss caused by humans encroaching upon
animals' habitats.
Caused by humans.
It's everything from paving over. We're going to get 25 million kilometers of new roads in the coming decades to cutting down forests and making mm-hmm. them into farms. That in itself is habitat loss. So that's the chief one. And it's also even in oceans, but it's mostly, you know, it's all heavily land-oriented. That's the first mm-hmm. one. And in oceans, we see overfishing. That's a major problem. Then you have climate change. And climate change and biodiversity loss are sort of intertwined. They make each other worse. They're sort of regarded as co-equal major environmental problems. For example, the warmer it gets, many species can't survive hotter temperatures. They have to move poleward, north in the northern hemisphere, south in the southern hemisphere, or they move into higher latitude, higher elevations. And some places they can't do that. And then you also have mismatches between species that are dependent on each other. But as biodiversity gets worse, as we chop down forests, that worsens climate change because forests suck up carbon dioxide, which are heat-trapping gases. So the two make each other worse. You have pollution in both land and water, and you have invasive species. So those are the five major ones.
And pretty much all of that caused by humans.
The invasive species, we sort of help because the invasive species piggyback on our boats and our airplanes. But that without us.
Right. Okay. And is there any particular part of the world that this report is saying really needs the most help?
This report is aimed globally. So last year they looked at each different part of the world and did reports. But in general, they are finding that the southern hemisphere is a little harder hit. And basically the effects of this, because this isn't just about nature, it's about nature and how it affects humans and how humans depend on nature. The poor people of the world, especially in the developing countries, are more dependent on nature than the richer developed countries. So they are getting hurt more.
Right. And so that's where a lot of the deforestation is taking place as well.
Exactly.
So is there any concerted effort to try to mitigate the effects of this?
Well, there have been numerous goals set by the United Nations, by global treaties set for 2020, for 2030. And this report also points out that we are nowhere near reaching any of those goals. So they've set all these goals and they're not reaching it.
Okay, so what happens if 1 million species of animals and plants is lost?
Yeah, not only will we be a poorer place, but the idea is it might be a hungrier place. Even though right now food production is increasing, food with less diversity, the food is supposed to get more expensive. There may be less of it, and then you also have clean water. Some of these species help clean our water, so we depend on species even for everything from 70% of cancer drugs come from species, so from nature. So sometimes we won't know what we miss. But even if you live in the most urban city out there, you depend on nature. You just may not know it.
Mm. Okay. And it's hard for this to get people to care, because we keep hearing these dire reports of global warming and species loss and all that. Is there something in this report that is getting people to say, okay, this is the thing that is going to make people, governments, change their policies?
Well, the overall effect of it has already got the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, to say they are going to change some of their economic ways, and how they work with plastics. And that was just today, just a few minutes ago, actually. So it may have some effect there. But the some of these transformations that this says we need are so global, they require not just an individual country to do something, but countries to do something together. It requires the action of locals. It requires the action of companies. And even people themselves can do things. So whether it will get people to do it, that's something hard to tell, because, people move on to the next problem the next day.
Right. So individually, we can do things like not eating as much meat, not throwing away as much food, things like that.
Exactly. Thomas Lovejoy, who is sort of the godfather of biodiversity, said, we now can produce all the food we need, even need in the future, on all the cropland that we have, if we just reduce food waste tremendously and are more efficient about how we eat and what we eat. And we're not even talking going vegetarian or vegan. We're talking more of a balance, the scientists say. Less meat, more fruits and vegetables.
Okay. Seth Bornstein, science reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, taking a quick break from the program to get you to go online at kcrw.com/join and join us here at KCRW. Become a member or renew your membership. Upgrade your membership. Maybe you did give earlier. You're still a valid member, but you think, hey, I'm doing pretty well. I can afford to toss in a few more bucks, because this is our spring membership drive, and we come to you just twice a year to get your support. It's that simple. We cannot be on the air without you, the public. This is public radio, after all. We are not corporately funded. We are funded by the public. And that means a lot these days in this news environment, a news environment that, by the way, is shrinking nationwide. KCRW.com/join. That is the place to go. Lots of great thank you gifts there. You can get a subscription to the New York Times or the Washington Post, or you can contribute to the LA Regional Food Bank. You can pick up some swag, some brand new designs for t-shirts, hats, whatever. But just go online right now, and thank you so much. Coming up, our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to talk about the Democrats' efforts to subpoena Donald Trump's financial records. We'll have that for you next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California, and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. House Democrats are getting involved in a lawsuit between Donald Trump and two banks. The Democrats want Trump's financial records, but he has sued the banks to prevent them from releasing those records. And now the Democrats say they want to intervene in that lawsuit. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So what does it mean to intervene in a lawsuit?
Who knew I was ever going to be able to use first-year civil procedure live on the radio?
Is that a technical legal term?
It is. Whether or not you can intervene actually is a technical legal question. And it essentially means that you have an interest that needs to be represented in court. And that's what the House Democrats are saying. They're saying this is between the Trump administration right now and the bank. But hey, what about us? We're the ones who subpoenaed these documents. Let us come into court and also defend our reasoning.
Mm. And this is for Deutsche Bank and for Capital One, these two financial outlets.
Yes, because what they're saying is we need this information from Deutsche Bank, which President Trump has done a lot of business with before he was President Trump, that they need information from his accounting firm, that they need all this information to look into issues like potential conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest. And they're saying this is a valid exercise of our subpoena power.
Right. And he's saying this is a politically motivated fishing expedition.
He is saying that. Now, I don't think that's going to be a successful argument because Congress has broad subpoena power. And the truth is, you can be motivated by politics, but still have valid legal ground to do so. So there's a reason Republicans weren't asking for this information when they were in control of Congress, because it wasn't politically expedient. But just because the Democrats have a partisan reason, that doesn't mean that it's an invalid exercise of the subpoena power. You can still have a good reason for asking, even if it's a political win, if you get it.
Right. But how far back can they go? Because can't he argue that for decades he was a private citizen, a private businessman, and this has nothing to do with his role now as a public servant? And are they even allowed to have all of these records? Isn't there some kind of notion of privacy between the bank and its client?
There absolutely are notions of privacy. So what the Congress can do is say, we're just looking at it. It's not going to be public. So that's one way where you can control privacy. And we talked about this a little bit when it came to the issue of members of Congress asking for President Trump's tax returns. There, the issue isn't, will they become public? The issue is, will these members of Congress get to see it? You could also have a situation where the banks would, for instance, redact portions of those tax filings or other financial filings. So it's not an all or nothing. I do think that there is a line, and that's not a bright line, we don't know where it is, where it just looks like, okay, you don't get his preschool records, but mm-hmm. you get something else.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, speaking of tax returns, the California legislature wants to make it so that if you don't release your tax returns and you are a candidate for higher office, you don't get to be on the ballot.
No ballot for you. Yes.
Is that legal?
Maybe. Don't you love it when the answer is maybe? But the truth is, there's good arguments on both sides of this. So this came up, actually, I believe it was about 18 months ago, where both the California Senate and the California Assembly passed this law or passed this proposal where they said, you don't get to go on the ballot unless you have disclosed 5 years of tax returns. And Governor Jerry Brown at the time, who had not disclosed his tax returns for a number of years, and I think even before when he ran for president in the early 90s, said, no, I don't think so. And he said, because there's reasons, there are legal reasons why maybe you can't.
And so he vetoed it?
So he vetoed it. Now, this is obviously a different political climate. You have Governor Gavin Newsom, who has released years of taxes, but the legal arguments remain the same. And so the legal arguments basically boil down to states don't get to add new requirements to run for office. In order to run for president, the Constitution tells us you have to be at least 35, natural born citizen, live in the country 14 years. And so a state doesn't get to say, and you have to be wealthy, or you have to be a woman, or you have to have at least a law degree. You don't get to add an additional requirement. But states can add conditions. So, for instance, you need a certain number of signatures. You need to pay a filing fee. And it's a really complicated question, but it kind of boils down to which bucket do you fall in?
Well, so have states added these kinds of things generally? I mean, aside from getting a number of signatures on you know, to qualify, other things that are a little nebulous?
They have tried. So there are about 24 states that have proposals similar to California's. It will shock everyone to know that those are all states that have legislatures that are controlled by Democrats. And
one so they haven't tried this until now, is what you're saying.
They haven't tried this this particular issue until now, but partly because for the last 40 years, presidential candidates have released their tax returns. And so one of the cases that people look to is a case dealing with term limits, where there was one state that tried to impose term limits on members of Congress, essentially saying, if you've already served X number of years, you don't get to be on the ballot. Now, in that case, the court says that's an additional requirement. Go home. And so a lot of people are looking at that case for guidance. Also, kind of surprisingly, looking at Bush v. Gore for guidance, because that deals with, obviously, the right to vote, how you count votes for president. And the truth is, any state can actually take away the people's right to vote for president. So the way you elect a president is obviously through electors. And so some people are saying, well, look, if the state can take away your ability to weigh in at all, then can't they just say, in order to get on the ballot, you have to release your taxes? So that's basically the state of play legally.
Okay. And he is sure to challenge this in court, Donald Trump, if Governor Newsom signs it.
As you know, I never like to say absolutely yes or absolutely no, and absolutely positively yes, this will be challenged.
Okay, very quickly, we have less than a minute. A federal court has thrown out Ohio's congressional map, saying it is an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. We talked about this recently, maybe last week with Michigan. There's a lot of this going on now.
There's a lot of this going around. Everybody seems to be catching partisan gerrymandering fever. So it was just last week that we talked about the Michigan case. And the case coming out of Ohio is very similar in the sense that what the court said is you overstepped Republicans. You drew district lines in a way that dilutes voter power. And you don't get to do that. Now, the big question, obviously, isn't exactly what's going on in Ohio, what's going on in Michigan. It's what is the Supreme Court going to do with the two pending cases before it? Now, it's becoming increasingly difficult for the Supreme Court to say federal judges just have no way of divining a standard for partisan gerrymandering when now we have two decisions where that's absolutely what the judges have done.
Wow. Okay. Fascinating and all, you know, relevant for 2020, right?
Very relevant for 2020 and beyond. This decision is a big one for decades and decades if we say judges can weigh in on policing partisan gerrymandering.
Jessica Levinson, our law professor from Loyola Law School, our very own law professor, otherwise known as the Legal Eagle. She's here every Monday. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Okay, if you love yourself some Legal Eagle, now's the time to show that love. KCLB.com/join. We want you to weigh in and say yes to this station, yes to the show, and yes, primarily, to the Legal Eagle. KCLB.com/join. Coming up, Instagram experiments with hiding the likes on photos.
I've kind of made a conscious effort to be like, I'm going to post what makes me feel good. Caring a little bit less about the number just feels like it's like a weight off your shoulders.
We'll have that story. And we're going to meet Eva. She was killed in the Holocaust, but her story is being told now on Instagram in an effort to connect Generation Z with history. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is Eva.
That's me. It's 1944. The Nazis have conquered most of Europe, and they do terrible things to us Jews. But they haven't conquered us, and the Russians will save us. And I'm about to turn 13.
That's from an initiative that shows the life of a young Jewish girl during the Holocaust through Instagram stories. It's based on the diary entries of Eva Heyman. She was born in Romania in 1931 and was murdered in Auschwitz in 1944. This Instagram Stories project shows the last few months of her life as if she had an Instagram and a smartphone. So Eva is played by an actress. The idea is to connect a young generation to the Holocaust in a language they can relate to, Instagram. But some are saying that making Eva's story into an Instagram story really trivializes the horror of the Holocaust. Josephine Dolston is a staff writer for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency News Service, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, we heard just a short clip there. Can you describe to us in more detail what this looks like?
Yeah, so Eva Stories is a series of videos and photos posted on Instagram that tell us about Eva Heyman's life. It's posted in a way that looks like how teens use Instagram today. There are selfies of her with her friends. Eva talks to the camera as if she's talking to you. There are emojis, polls, Eva talking about her crush. It's done in a very casual way, but it also gets into a lot of dark topics as well.
So the fact that it's done in a casual way, is that what people are objecting to?
Yeah, I think when people first heard about it before the project premiered, just hearing Holocaust and Instagram together seems pretty strange. We think of Instagram as a platform for selfies and posting photos of food, and not necessarily a place where we would educate about a genocide. So even just using that as a platform is controversial. And the trailer they put out really portrayed some of the more lighthearted moments. It really struck some people as a bit distasteful to portray the life of a young girl who died in the Holocaust in such a lighthearted way.
And who put this out? Where did it come from?
Yeah, this was created and funded by an Israeli tech executive and his daughter. They made it. It took them 3 weeks to film this in the Ukraine, and they used actors to portray all the different characters.
And so it's kind of like a short film, right? But cut up into Instagram bite-sized pieces.
Sort of. Well, it's made to look like the girl filmed it herself. So it looks as if someone is filming it from an iPhone or something like that. The camera is not always steady. She sometimes holds it up and just speaks to it as if she's speaking to you. So it is like a film in a sense, but the way it's filmed is more unique and really shows how people film on Instagram.
Okay, so what did you think when you saw it?
Well, I'll admit, when I first heard of it, I was a little shocked or taken aback like a lot of people. I have read a lot of things about the Holocaust, been to various museums. I've never heard of anything like this. But as I watched it, it really struck a chord with me. I think what's really unique here is that it's done in such a casual way, sort of from the point of view of a 13-year-old, that you really understand what it's like for a young girl going through something so horrible. It's not just the hard parts, but you also see her talking about her crush. You see life as it would have been experienced by someone of that age, and it's quite touching, and you really feel like you're getting to know this girl.
Hmm. And so I guess that's the intent, right, on the part of this Israeli tech executive and his daughter who put this together, was to connect the story of the Holocaust from, you know, decades and decades ago to modern life now, and to get people, 13-year-olds like Eva, to care.
Right. I think it's both about making it in a way that's very relatable and really makes you feel as if you're there with Eva, as well as putting it on a platform that is extremely popular among teens. I interviewed teenagers about this project for an article I wrote, and you know, I asked them, oh, do you use Instagram a lot? They said, all of my friends use Instagram. I don't know anyone who's not on Instagram. So putting it on Instagram is a way of really reaching teens where they are. And they might not seek out a book or a film about the Holocaust, but they're already on Instagram. So it's a combination of both having content that is very engaging and very personal, as well as putting it on a platform that teens are using every single day.
And so what did they think of it?
Yeah, I was very curious because there's a lot of criticism of this, but a lot of the criticism came from older people who hadn't even watched it. This is not meant for older people. This is meant for teenagers. Some of the teenagers did share the concerns that maybe some people would watch it and not take it seriously enough. But then there were a few who really couldn't even think of a downside to putting such a project on Instagram. One 14-year-old I spoke to, she said this was more engaging to her than anything she had studied about the Holocaust in school. And this was an Israeli girl who has learned a lot about the Holocaust. I think that a lot of the teens really connected to Eva because the way her story is told is really the same way that they look at stories from their friends or that they experience life.
Okay, you can check it out at eva.stories on Instagram. Josephine Dolston is a staff writer for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Doing it for the gram, clout chasing, insta-famous. This slang translates into one thing, likes. Well, recently, Instagram announced it's exploring hiding how many likes a post gets. Users would still be able to see who liked their own posts, but their followers would not. Some people are concerned this will change the whole experience and the whole community on Instagram, but others are hoping, well, this will make Instagram less competitive, less corrosive. It's only happening right now in Canada. It's an experiment, but if it catches on, Instagram could expand this idea. We're going to hear from a Canadian influencer about her experience under the new regime in a moment. But first, we're joined by Jeremy Latah. He's a professor of journalism and communication, and he specializes in digital media at Lehigh University. Welcome.
Hi.
So why is Instagram doing this?
I think that they're worried a little bit about some of the social effects of what they've unleashed on us all. It has created, as you mentioned, a competitive culture around, when you expose people who are following somebody on Instagram to the number of likes and comments that they see, it cues them in a little ways that kind of says this is something that's popular, something I should be paying attention to. And so it kind of creates a type of one-up culture that I compare a little bit to high school, where, you know, we're trying to figure out who the most popular people are, most interesting people are. And sometimes that's being judged by criteria that are a little bit out of our control. So you take a look at some of the research that's been coming out the last couple of years about body image, for example, in visual media. And, there's some real worries, I'm sure, within those halls about, what are we creating here? And are we creating something that tends to prize a type of conventional standard beauty that as culture defines it in a way that might be harmful to some people? So I think that's driving some of this. I think some of it's also just about the internal tug of war between Instagram and its parent company, Facebook, as they're kind of competing for the spotlight. Facebook's had a rough couple of years. And so I think that this is an attempt, I think, in some ways to kind of pull back some of that influence Instagram has.
Right. So Facebook owning Instagram. And would this actually affect their bottom line, though? Would advertisers not like this if they can't see themselves how many likes a post gets?
The bigger worry, I think, probably for an advertiser or even an influencer, I would say, is lack of engagement probably could potentially lead to lack of use. If somebody can't see how many, if there's no way for me to represent how popular I am, for example, for an average user, that my friends can't see how much my posts are getting liked, there might be some sense of like, I'm just going to flee to a different platform. So I think that there's the long-term danger probably for them is that people will see the service is less useful if they are really there for the likes.
Aren't we all in it for the likes, though? Isn't that the whole point?
I would say, yeah. I mean, like, so some of the way these social networks are designed, they tap into some of the classic psychology research done by B.F. Skinner that takes a look at like the small little dopamine hits we get from just a positive interaction from something we post, and so we are encouraged to keep coming back and keep posting because we're getting those small affirmations. And so I think that's, you could say maybe that's not the reason we're there, but I think it's the reason we keep coming back.
So is this, you said that Instagram may be worried, and Facebook too, worried about the social effects of these likes. Do you think that it's also worried about all the, really bad stuff that goes on in social media, like the hate speech, the trolling and all that? And do you think this is a way that this could actually curb that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Instagram has not faced the same kind of public relations problems that Twitter and Facebook have in terms of hate content. When you think about the trolls and abuse that we often talk about with Facebook and Twitter, it's just not there. I do think that, though, that you know, when you think about different ways to find it, or if you do stumble across it somehow, that, you know, it would be problematic for the company to know that, like, a post from a white supremacist group, for example, has 200,000 likes. Or you see how many followers they have. So hiding those types of stats definitely does limit, I think, the sense of influence. It's one thing if it's like a random neo-Nazi group out there posting stuff and it has no likes and no influence. You know, the audience takes a type of cue from that that's really important. But when you start to see all the pileup effects of people liking it over and over again, in this case, you know, you have bots maybe potentially even doing it, that sets a different kind of expectation for the audience. Like, you may not need to be sucked into a white supremacist message, but you might overestimate the influence you think that that account has. So I do think that some of this could potentially be about trying to head that stuff off. But I will say that Instagram has done a pretty good job, I think, making sure its service doesn't surface the objectionable kinds of stuff that does come out on Facebook and Twitter a little more often.
Jeremy Latta is Associate Professor of Journalism and Communication at Lehigh University, where he studies digital media. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now let's turn to Katie Hobbins. She's the co-founder of Caden Avenue Communications. That's a social media firm. And she is an Instagram influencer herself in Canada. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Okay, so you're seeing this experiment playing out in real life, I guess, on your Instagram. What's happening with your likes?
Yeah, so just over the weekend, actually, it happened. I signed in one day and there was a little message from Instagram at the top that said, "We're changing how you view your likes." There wasn't really an option to opt in or out. It was just basically them informing me. And as soon as I hit the OK button, all of a sudden the likes are there, but the count is gone. So I can see if I click on the photo who has liked it, but it just shows to me, it'll say like Sam Smith and others have liked this photo. It doesn't display the amount, and I can't see the amount for any other people in my feed.
And how do you feel about that?
Honestly, relieved. When I started on Instagram, I was a pretty early adopter, and it's kind of how I got so many followers all at once. I found it was a lot easier to kind of build yourself a niche and become influential on Instagram back in like 2012, I would say. And it was chronological at that point in time as well. So if you had a good post and people were liking it, it was easy for you to kind of gain a bit of traction. And now with the algorithm, I find sometimes things take off, other things that used to do well for me weren't, and it was really hard to kind of determine what was causing that. And eventually I kind of just gave up on trying to play the algorithm game and just posted whatever.
What seems to do well for you?
Before, it used to be any photo that was actually like well composed. Like, I used to do a lot of kind of urban exploration and people really would like seeing cool angles and visuals. And now it seems like the only thing I can get to perform well is a selfie, which is sort of maddening. For me, I don't really, there are ways that you can sort of game the system with likes, which I think is partially why Instagram has made this change. We can talk about those a little bit if you want as well.
Please. How do you game the system of likes?
I don't know if other influencers are going to be mad, but there's something called Instagram pods or comment pods that a lot of influencers will participate in. And so what you do is you join either a separate group on Instagram, like in your direct messages, or on another platform entirely. And what you do is when you have a new post, you drop it in the group, and everyone in that group then must like your post and leave a relevant comment. Sometimes there's rules around what kind of comments to leave. They have to be at least 3 words. Emojis don't count. But the catch is you have to go back and like and comment on every post that's been dropped before yours. So
wow.
This can turn into a snowball effect where you can get 100 new likes and comments, but you also have to go back and do the work and like everyone else's. And it'll inflate your metrics. And the point is, I guess, to beat the algorithm and make it look like your post is very engaging, when in reality, it's just kind of you and your 100 of your influencer friends pumping each other up.
Well, you make money off this, right? This is your job.
It is. So my business partner and I, we manage other small business Instagram accounts. So that's where I make the majority of my money. But I do some influencer partnerships on my own Instagram with brands.
And so how would this affect you financially?
I think for me, it'll be okay for managing other people's accounts. We try to encourage our clients not to put too much stock into vanity metrics like likes, partially because of reasons like this, like they could just disappear at any time. For us, we try to encourage them and tell them it's not about the numbers. It's about having your actual customers following you and giving them a good customer journey and experience, and then maybe converting them. So whether that's getting them to book an appointment if it's a hair salon, or
click through to the link in your bio to purchase a product. We try to have those as goals and outcomes that we report to them rather than just how many people are liking their photos.
And you said it was a relief for you, this new system. Can you describe why? Why it's so relieving?
I think as much as I didn't really want to feed into like tying Instagram likes to any sort of like validation, it happens. We're humans and we like when people praise us or when we think that we've shown people something that's cool, or we like personal validation. And for me, sometimes if I had a photo that I didn't think would do well, maybe it was like a cool photo of a building or a landscape, I would maybe not post it because I'd be like, oh, this isn't going to perform well with my followers. Like, people are going to see that I didn't get as many likes on this. Maybe I shouldn't post it. And now, since that's changed, I've kind of made a conscious effort to be like, I'm going to post what makes me feel good, what I think is actually interesting in my life, whether that's my dog or what I'm seeing in front of me, or maybe it is a selfie that I felt I looked good that day. But caring a little bit less about the number just feels like it's like a weight off your shoulders.
Hmm. Well, good luck. And I hope you still like the likeless future on Instagram.
I hope progresses. I do too. I hope other people do, because that's how I make my living. So if Instagram dies, I'll have to find a new job.
Katie Hobbins, co-founder of Caden Avenue Communications. She's an Instagram influencer herself. Her username is Katie Dane, KADYDANE. Go like her. Okay, so Greater LA host Steve Chiotakis is here, and we have a challenge. It's a little friendly competition, right, Steve?
I can't with you. I cannot with you. I certainly cannot with you today.
It is happening on Instagram, on KCRW's Instagram. That's at KCRW, to see who can get more likes.
You're winning right now.
Before Instagram hides them.
This is ridiculous. It really is.
Well,
it's very upsetting.
My show is on now, and yours will be on later, and that's when you'll get more likes.
I get it, okay?
Who's the greater influencer?
I understand. It's fine. You've been around in this market for a lot longer than I have.
It's very silly, but anyway, that's what it is.
I love you. I'm going to, you know what? This is what I'm going to do, because I'm such a good sport. I'm going to like yours.
That's,
I just liked it.
Generous of you.
See what I just did?
That I did. I saw that, and I'll do that too.
At Radio Chio. Oh, wait, that's mine. This is at KCRW.
Okay. Well, what's coming up on your show?
What is coming up on my show? We're going to talk today about SROs. Have you ever been to, you've been to downtown LA, obviously. You've seen these old hotels. They've been there for ages, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of these places are just a bedroom, a shared bathroom, no kitchen. It's like a hotel, but people live there and they pay rent, sometimes $300-$500 a month, sometimes even more. It can be really bougie, like in Venice. They're creating these new kinds of SROs that people live in without a kitchen or a bathroom.
Right.
Bougie SROs. But we're talking about the original ones that are trying to get people off the street because it's much cheaper rent.
Yeah.
So you're one step up from homelessness. We're going to talk about that coming up. And Gustavo Arellano on being more respectful at the Orange County Board of Supervisors meetings.
Who's got to be more respectful?
Well, that's just the way it is in Orange County as opposed to LA County.
Oh, where it's not.
Where it's not respectful at all. I will just tell you there will be some bleeping in the segment.
Wow.
So be prepared.
Wow. Yeah. Who knew? It got so spicy at these meetings.
It gets a little spicy.
Okay. Well, it gets a little spicy on Instagram too, so.
Should I look?
Maybe.
You want to talk? We have a pledge drive that we're doing.
Let's talk about that. That's a little more important.
Right?
Speaking of liking, we want you to seriously like KCRW. Well, you obviously do if you're listening
right now. You're up to 67,
by
the way. This is ridiculous.
67.
I'm at 53.
Is nothing in the influencer world. So KCRW.com/join. We have a lot of tasks for you to do that, to go on the Instagram, all of this stuff. KCRW.com/join, because we are in our UnDrive. Fun drive.
You know what's so funny? It's like I walked into the building and you remember like old public radio, walk in there like, yeah, 1,000 people in here. They're all answering the phones and the phones are ringing and all that stuff. It's not like that,
not.
I mean, we love the volunteers to see the people who are behind the scenes and they're still here. But it's like you don't hear it on the radio.
Yeah, you don't hear it on the radio, but you do hear the radio, and you only hear it because of support from the listeners. So go online now, please. We've got a lot of thank you gifts there, a lot of reasons to give. KCRW.com/join. And thank you. Coming up on this program, Fanny, the first all-female rock band, critically praised, but now largely forgotten. We're going to try to remedy that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Monday, so that means it's time to talk about music on the show. Not new music this week, but music from the late 1960s, early 70s that has been seriously overlooked. When I found out that you took me for a ride, I wondered if I should stay faithful by your side. They tell me it's a mistake. Yeah, I've had about all I can take, and I think I'm gonna change horses in midstream. That's Fanny, the first all-female rock band signed to a major label. Never heard of them? Well, they got their start right here in Los Angeles. David Bowie once called them one of the most important female bands in American rock. And we're going to find out why no one's really heard of them with writer Dylan Rupert. She spent some time with Fanny for season two of KCRW's show Lost Notes. Fanny's story is one of several told this season about women who've been overlooked by music history. And Dylan Tupper Rupert joins me now. Hi.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, so let's begin with who is Fanny?
Fanny was a band of four women. It was started by two sisters, Jean and June Millington. And they came to America from the Philippines. They grew up in the Philippines, and then their family moved them to Sacramento when they were in junior high. And they learned how to play rock and roll kind of when the rock and roll craze was starting to hit in the mid-60s. And that led to them forming a few bands. And eventually, once they got out of high school, they came down to LA, got discovered at the Troubadour, got signed to Reprise Records, which is the major label that was founded by Frank Sinatra and was a very like artist-forward, creative major label, really prestigious at the time. And they had a pretty prolific recording career as the first all-female rock band to put out a record on a major label.
So back then, they were on Reprise Records. They were prolific. Were they popular?
They were definitely popular in the LA circuit. They were opening for like Jethro Tull and Humble Pie and Chuck Berry. And this is my favorite part of the story. Reprise rented them this mansion on top of the Hollywood Hills, right above Chateau Marmont. So they lived for free, like with their, yeah, 19.
All four of them?
All four of them.
In the house.
In the house. And they're 19, 20, 21. And they just have this compound and it just sounds like a total magical rock fairy tale, like the most fun sorority ever. And so they get signed in 1968. They are getting increasingly more popular just kind of in the LA circuit. They break through on the Billboard charts a bit. They break through in into the top 40, which is interesting because at the time, Billboard only had pop charts. They didn't have a separate designated rock chart, so it's like a bit more of an achievement to think of like a rock band being top 40 at the time. They never really fully broke through the way that many of their peers did.
Which is the million-dollar question, right, for your show, right?
Right.
So why? Why not them when others did?
As much as I wish there was, like, the straightforward answer that could solve the problem of why it took women in rock so long to be taken seriously, which is really the core of, you know, the Fanny story, it was kind of just a mix of how hard it is to be a pioneer when you have very few peers and mentors to kind of help you through the rough spots.
But you do have female rock stars at the time. You have Janis Joplin, Grace Slick, even Mama Cass from the Mamas and the Papas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were female rock stars at the time.
True.
Was it the fact that it was just an all-female band that made them slightly different?
I think it was. I think it was really perceived as a novelty that these women were writing their own songs and performing them, and that there's a woman on drums, bass, guitar. You know, a lot of their questions from interviewers at the time are like, how does it feel being a woman playing such a phallic instrument? And they're like, I don't know. It feels like I'm playing the guitar. What? So they kind of cite their lack of really breaking through to, they wanted to glam us up. They wanted to make us sexier. We were a t-shirt and jeans band. They wanted to make us like a cropped halter top and bell bottoms kind of band. And it just kind of chiseled away at their confidence. It was definitely more of like a fizzle out at the end of their career than any kind of big explosion.
Tell us about the two at the heart of this band, the sisters, Jean and June.
Mm-hmm.
They're from the Philippines.
Yeah, they grew up in the Philippines. Their dad was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, and their mom was a socialite, and they kind of grew up like upper class in the Philippines. And so their kind of musical inclinations were encouraged, and they had piano lessons and all that sort of thing. So when they came to the States, you know, just by virtue of being new immigrants, they definitely saw their class stature kind of go down a few rungs. And that kind of jarred them, but also gave them more motivation to like want to learn how to play rock and roll, because they realized that made them, they were invisible, and then once they played rock and roll, they were popular suddenly in junior high. But June's like a total firebrand. She's 71 now, and she's kind of the band's historian. Over the last couple decades, she wrote a 600-page autobiography.
Oh.
So everything you want to know about Fanny, you can find in Land of Thousand Bridges by June Millington. Very long.
And she's the older sister.
She's the older sister. And her younger sister, Jean, was the guitarist, and she sang a lot of the songs. And she kind of like, I don't know, she seems like she kind of had a flirty past, a fun and flirty rock and roll time.
Was she the wilder of the two?
I have the sense she was a bit of the wilder of the two. Don't get me wrong, they were pretty innocent by this era's standards. They were really focused on their music. They were kind of just dazzled by the whole experience. But they had good times.
Well, speaking of time, let's hear a song from them. It's called Borrowed Time. You sit high with your servants at your feet. Yeah, that really sounds like a hit.
They rock.
It's got a hook. They rock.
Hard.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard. It's poppy. It's fun. It's crazy to me that that wasn't a hit.
That was not a hit.
That's one of my favorite Fanny songs. I'm a little biased, but.
And so, like I said in the intro, David Bowie really liked them.
David Bowie, there's a quote. We actually start off the episode with this quote. But David Bowie basically says that Fanny was like one of the finest bands of their time. Not just female bands, just bands, period. And he said, revivify Fanny, and if you do, my work here will be done. So I am but a humble servant of David Bowie's wishes.
His vision, yes.
But they had a lot of respect from their peers at the time. And some, you know, their peers were like Bonnie Raitt and Lowell George of Little Feat. They recorded with Jeff Emerick, who's the Beatles engineer, and he really was an advocate for them. So they had a lot of allyship kind of in the music industry.
So it is really confounding that they didn't become major stars.
It's crazy. I want to fix it.
Okay. Why not?
Yeah.
So they're both alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are they doing now?
So June is in her early 70s, and a couple decades ago, I think, she started an institute in Massachusetts called the Institute of Musical Arts. And what they do, so now it's kind of like a thing nationwide where there's all these different organizations that do rock camps for girls, which is awesome. But she was one of the first organizations to set that up. And then Jean went on and she became an herbalist, and she lives in Davis, just outside of Sacramento. And she recently, in the last couple of years, suffered a stroke. So Fanny's actually been like getting the band back together and doing some benefit shows in the Sacramento area to benefit her recovery fund. But besides that, I mean, they're in great shape. They're hilarious on tape. It was really fun going down memory lane.
Okay, well, you can hear them. You can hear the full story on KCRW's Lost Notes. It airs May 16th, right? You can download it. Do that.
Subscribe. All the other episodes are spectacular as well.
Excellent. Dylan Tupper Rupert, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I guarantee no ship of fate.
Great. We are almost to the end of the show, so we're just going to take a few seconds out of this at the end of the show to get you to go online at kcrw.com/join. This is the beginning of week two of our UnDrive fundraiser. We come to you twice a year to get you to support your public radio station. And this time we're doing something different. We are not interrupting any programming, none of it. So none of those lengthy pitch breaks. We're just coming to you in between shows, in between segments to ask you to do your part. kcrw.com/join. A lot of you are already doing that, and that's fantastic. And we're asking you to support us at the $20 a month level if you can do that. Maybe upgrade your existing membership or renew your existing membership. And just for today, if you do, you will be automatically entered to win your place in KCRW history. You know, we're in a brand new building and we have not held a live performance in this building yet, a live musical performance. So you will be able to attend the inaugural live broadcast performance on Morning Becomes Eclectic from our new studios with, drumroll please, James Blake. So if you like that kind of music, if you like James Blake, if you like KCRW and you want to hang out in the studio, well, meet him and join us. You can. KCRW.com/join. One lucky winner will be picked today. So thank you for your support. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.